grab some popcorn and a favorite chair. The love of movies is why we're here. Press play and don't delay. Let Phil be our guide to a cinematic day. Phil at the movies, from the silver screen to his podcast stream. Phil's covering every movie dream. Phil at the movies. Phil at the movies.
Mr. Schwartz,
call me Marvin. Put it there. That's your son?
No, it's my stunt double, Cliff Booth.
Last night, we watched a Rick Dalton double feature. All the shooting. I love that stuff, you know, the killing.
A lot of killing.
Anybody order fried sauerkraut?
Line.
Cut! Embarrass yourself like that in front of all those goddamn people!
All right, what's the matter, Parker?
It's official, old buddy. Well, it has been.
August night and the leaves hanging down and the grass.
And hello, everybody. Welcome back to yet another episode of Phil at the Movies. I'm your host, Phil Walsh, and this is episode number 161 of this ongoing podcast that is, you guessed it, For the Love of Movies. And today, I am delighted to be welcoming back for the first time in 2025, Mr. Chris Evans from Gathering of the Geeks. Welcome back, Chris, and it's been far too long, but better late than never, as they say.
Yeah, thank you for having me back, and especially to talk about what we're going to talk about. But I wanted to say, I didn't realize this was your 160th episode. That is amazing.
It's, you know, I have said this for the last few shows, and it bears repeating again. This is all possible because of you, the listeners and friends of this show. I honestly thought this would probably be 5, maybe 10 episodes. Like, you know, I'd probably run out of steam, like, you know, at the end of a 13, you know, episode season on TV or something. But no, here we are, you know, 161 episodes and going strong. And it is all because of you. So we're going to keep on going, keep on this cinematic journey. And I will occasionally spout off my cinematic philosophies and whatnot. But, in any event, you know, Chris, happy to have you here for this, you know, mini milestone, if you
yeah,
will.
It's a cool milestone.
No, honestly, here we go. You know, we're going to keep it going strong, everybody. Keep it going strong for the love of movies. But today, especially, because on that note, this podcast has been going on for 3 years, and this is the first time I can. I'm almost embarrassed to say this because I kind of feel like I should lose my film, you know, credential card or something. But I have not discussed a Quentin Tarantino film on this podcast in 3 years. Now, granted, there hasn't been any new Quentin Tarantino films, so there is sort of that little caveat. But at the same time, there are 9 films in this man's filmography. But up until today, not one has been discussed. But luckily, we are changing that. We are rectifying that. And what a better film, I think, to discuss today than what I would argue is Quentin's best film. And I certainly know that my friend and guest here has a lot of affection for this particular film. So we are going to be reviewing and discussing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the 9th film from Quentin Tarantino. And again, if you're watching this on YouTube, you can, of course, see the poster over my shoulder. So again, my film credential cards are secure. But in any event, Chris, let me start it off with you and just give a quick take, quick reaction to this film, and then we will unpack it, so to speak.
You said, I believe it's arguably his best film. To me, this is his best film. I adore this movie from start to finish. It is just such a special ride. And it's the little details that make it that much better, which we'll get into. But it's just such a well-made, well-rounded film. It has a little bit of everything. The casting is top-notch, whether they have, you know, 2 minutes of screen time or then the whole thing. It's just a phenomenal film, in my opinion.
Well said. Well said. And again, for those of you who may not have seen the film, though, I'm guessing if you're listening to this episode, of course, you probably have seen it at least once or twice. But let me just give you all a quick rundown of the plots, kind of set the scene here. As Hollywood's golden age is winding down during the summer of 1969, television actor Rick Dalton, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, and his stunt double Cliff Booth, played by Brad Pitt, endeavor to achieve lasting success in Hollywood while meeting several colorful characters along the way. And, I mean, I saw someone say once, and they were sort of, I think, in part in jest, like, oh, this movie really isn't about anything. I'm like, okay, I think that must be a joke here. Waiting for the punchline. I love how this movie is, and this is a phrase that I feel gets used a lot today, that it almost loses its currency. But here I think it really does apply. This film is a love letter to both movie making, to old Hollywood, to America circa 1969. I mean, this is, in many ways, I think it is Quentin's magnus opus. I mean, this is all of his skills, all of his creative endeavors coming to this point. And it just, another word that is often overused today that it loses its currency, but again, I think it does apply here. It's a masterpiece. And it's a masterpiece because of the way this story unravels in the best possible way. This could have simply just been a 2.5 hour buddy comedy, if you will. And you get a lot of great dynamics between DiCaprio and Pitt with their characters. And I love how he's sort of paying homage to the fading TV actor of the late 1950s, early 1960s, and then the stunt double who was sort of trying to figure out, okay, what's our next move here? The movie just could have been that for 2.5 hours, and it would have been entertaining. But the fact that he decides to not only create a sort of alternate reality, if you will, or alternate history by weaving in the Manson murders, if you will, or sort of putting it out there in the ether, and then subverting our expectations in the best possible way, and sort of making this a revenge story in a way, making it a quintessential fairy tale in a way. I mean, it's a comedy. It's a brilliant character study in a lot of ways. I mean, there's so many moving parts here, and as often as when that happens, you sometimes, can mix things up, or one part doesn't land more so than the other. Here, everything works, and it builds towards this. Just, it's a fairy tale like any. Like, you leave this film cheering, you leave this film happy. Like, it really does take you on such a wonderful ride, and you're fulfilled the entire way through. Like, again, you just sort of look at the interactions with some of the, even like you said, the characters that show up for like 5 minutes. Al Pacino is in this movie.
Al Pacino in this movie.
I mean,
what,
like,
a picture.
What a picture. No, that scene, rewatching it the other night, I was just amazed. One, again, he's in the film for no more than 5 minutes, but he almost steals the show in a way, just between his like you know, old Hollywood producer type. Like, again, you could just picture this guy right out of Central Casting.
He feels real. That's the thing. Like, Al Pacino brings something to every performance he does, even the Dunkachino thing. But he feels like a real person, which is a lot of the characters in this movie. They all feel real, but something about him especially, and he sets the tone in a way, I think, for the whole movie. He's a big star. He comes in, does a little part, has a couple of fantastic lines, and it sets the tone for everything to come.
Well, that's the thing. Like, when I say, like, this movie could have just been a 2 hour and change buddy comedy of just watching what adventures.
It could be like The Nice Guys.
Exactly. You know, and there's so much that you could sort of pick and choose with the interactions between Dalton and Booth. I mean, I love how the way this film starts. And again, this is another part of the brilliance of it. It starts with, like, the old bumper reels that you would get for a lot of these, you know, like 1950s, early 1960s, particularly cowboy westerns. Like, even though, of course, we know this is all imaginative and creative, like, I feel like Bounty Law was a real show. Like, just the attention to detail that goes on in here. And the fact that, like, yeah, I was sort of reading through a behind-the-scenes book. The fact that Tarantino wrote, like, 15 or 16 episodes and scripts for Bounty Law, again, never had any intention of shooting them. I mean, they obviously, you know, bits and pieces for the movie, but he actually took the time to write out individual episodes to set the tone. Like, I mean, that just enhances the credibility of this film. And again, just sort of lends itself to, this is a movie that is about so much, but at its core, it's a movie that loves movies. It loves the art of filmmaking and actors, and in particular, the underappreciated actor. And again, with Rick Dalton, I mean, I will say something I know may be controversial. I think this is DiCaprio's best performance. And I know you could make that case for a lot of his films, but what he's doing here is nothing short of brilliant. Here he is, this essentially washed up has-been, a guy who had his moment back in the 1950s, you know, a star, if you will, but clearly someone who is fading. And he doesn't understand this changing world of the new Hollywood that is emerging, where a lot of his contemporaries, you think of like Steve McQueen or you know, Clint Eastwood, who were sort of making the transition over either from television to movies, or in the case of Eastwood, was doing the spaghetti westerns and sort of making a name for himself that way. And Dalton is sort of stuck in this limbo where he doesn't know what to do, and he doesn't know how to be relevant anymore. And of course, I mean, there's so many scenes we could unpack, but there's that one that just sticks out to me where he's in his trailer dressing room. And I mean, just from like an acting standpoint, it's one of Leo's, I think it is his finest moment, but just to see like the sort of mini mental breakdown that he's having over the fact that he's screwing up his rehearsal, the fact that he can't hold his shit together, that, you know, he's saying, cursing himself, oh, you're a drunk, you're a horrible person. Like,
I love that scene so much. He mentions the whiskey sours, and that scene is, it's a great, so it's kind of funny in a way too.
Yeah,
I think the way it's presented, but like you're saying, his performance is what sells that thing.
Bingo.
Because anyone else, it would have just been like, I think it would have been goofy, because it's a guy arguing with himself.
Exactly. It could have been over the top.
Yeah, but it's not with him. It feels sincere.
And again, you sort of make that point earlier with Pacino. Like, we've already got the tone established for this thing, where there's going to be comedy, but it's going to be grounded in a way where we're almost seeing into the souls of these characters. Like, even some of the stuff we get with Cliff, where like there's sort of like these like questionable things. Okay, like, yeah, did he kill her? Like, you know, what's going on here in his background? We don't know. Even that, like, everything is sort of almost has like a farcical quality to it, but yet it's grounded in a way where it never feels like it loses the seriousness of what's going on. Like, again, not that this is like some heavy drama, but like, you know, again, you think of even that scene where DiCaprio was doing his his shot for for the Lancer show, mm-hmm. and he's sitting there in the bar, and of course he's already been in his head the entire time, and then the girl comes over to him and says, like, that was the best acting I have ever seen in my entire life. And of course he does the great line, Rick fucking Dalton,
it's iconic,
and again, it's become almost a meme at this point, but like, again, just the way he's able to both lean into the humor of it, but then also just give it that little extra notch. Like, again, like I said, there's so many scenes in this film where, like, they almost feel like mini movies within a movie, if that makes sense.
That's something I love about it, because that's exactly right. It feels like when you're watching the Lancer stuff,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't feel like I'm watching the Quentin Tarantino Once Upon a Time I'm in Hollywood film. I'm watching whatever the hell this show is about.
Right.
I'm kind of invested in what is happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Timothy Oliphant is there, who I also love. It's like, what is this story?
Yep.
Even that first scene with when he's eating the chicken. He comes out eating the chicken, and it's weird I'm going to say this, but there's so much personality. As soon as he comes out of the saloon, he just eating the chicken and talking. And it's all Leonardo DiCaprio. And like you said, the movie has this – It's never over the top. It has a slightly heightened sense of reality to it for the majority of it. At the end, it does some things. But the finale is the finale. The rest of it, though, has a slightly heightened sense of reality that just works. Mm-hmm. And when you see the films and the TV series, you don't really question it. You're just in for the ride. And I wouldn't have minded to see more of Lancer or whatever they had him in.
No, I mean, like, again, I'm waiting for, like, the 15 episode of Bounty Law to come out.
Are those scripts available?
Again, like, I would love to read those one day. I mean, but no, that's the thing. Like, the movie is constructed in a way where everything feels concise, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, even the stuff, and we can certainly get into it more in a minute. But don't be alarmed, everybody.
I've never seen the cat, so that kind of shocked me.
Yeah, I know. If you're watching this, if you're listening, my cat is behind me. But again, don't be alarmed, viewers. It's okay. I promise you, nothing spooky going on here. Even some of the stuff with Margot Robbie her portrayal of Sharon Tate, like, mm-hmm. Putting aside sort of the ending and finale moments, like, just the way her character is constructed, where we're sort of going through just sort of a day in the life of Sharon Tate, like when she goes to the movie theater, for example, like that feels like, again, another like a movie within a movie, but it enhances this whole overall almost like, again, dreamlike quality. And again, not that this is like, obviously it's a imaginative retelling of historical events, but it sort of lends itself to being almost, again, fairy tale-esque. Yeah, there we go. That was the word I was looking for.
And, something I really appreciate about the Sharon Tate portrayal is in like the Leonardo DiCaprio stuff, we're seeing him inserted into things that were real here and there.
Right.
With Sharon Tate, they didn't do that. And I really appreciate that they didn't do that. Just because of how tragic Sharon Tate's story actually is, I think it would have been a negative thing to insert Margot Robbie into the photos and the video footage. I think they did the right thing.
Oh no, that was perfectly handled. And again, save for how the ending works, which obviously we'll get to all of that in a bit. One of the critiques that I have seen people make about this film is that, Margot Robbie doesn't have much dialogue, and therefore, that's a disrespect to Sharon Tate. But I never saw it that way, because on that point, because this is a small gap of time that this story is, I mean, we're essentially looking at a matter of weeks and ultimately like a number of months in 1969. I think if you were to just invent, if you will, scenarios where Sharon Tate was popping up, that would have been disrespectful to both her, yes. her history, her person, to be like, well, let's, show her interacting with, you know, Cliff Booth just for the hell of it. Like, you know, okay, yeah, you would have had more dialogue and obviously, you know, been, you know, great story fodder, but like, to me, that would have been missing the point. Like, when this film rewrites history, it does it, I think, in a way that feels justified, instead of just doing it for the sake of, well, she isn't speaking enough, so we have to create scenarios for her character to talk. Like that to me seems almost unnecessary.
I didn't even think that she had few lines myself. I thought she's in it just the right amount, speaks just the right amount, because she's not the focus of the story. She's an addition to the story.
Right.
And I think her parts really sell the Hollywood dream aspect, mm-hmm. which you get that, you know, Rick Dalton's star is fading.
Yeah.
And then you have hers, who is just starting to glow.
Right.
So you get that nice contradiction, and them living next to each other makes it even better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think she's in it the perfect amount. I do get the criticism, though. There's also a lot of people, I think, who are upset with the way she was portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's not Sharon Tate enough. But I don't really think that matters in this scenario. And there's another character who people get really upset at, you know, their appearance in it.
Well, that, I mean, that's actually a good segue, which we can lead into. There is the Bruce Lee of it all.
Yes.
Again, what I love about this film is that our two lead characters, Cliff Booth, Rick Dolan, these are fictional characters. They are not, I mean, there may be real life inspirations and composites, but at the end of the day, these are fictional characters existing in the context of real events circa 1969. So I think, number one, that's important. Number two, this is a fantasy, as you said. Like, this is again, we have sort of the parameters of historical context, but there's a lot of sand, if you will, in the middle where we can kind of play around and do some different things. And again, when you look at the context of, we'll just take Cliff, for example, he's presented from the start as somebody who is larger than life. He is presented as somebody who may be untruthful. You know, again, there's a lot of moving parts in his background. So again, I know people have taken a lot of issue with the Bruce Lee sequence and how he is portrayed in the film. I think we have to look at it really from the context of Cliff's point of view. And this is his telling, this is his, you know, imagination or what have you of this particular event. And I think we can all relate in our own lives, whenever we tell a story about something that happens to us, we always do our part to make ourselves appear like we came out on top in any situation, or put us in the best possible spotlight. And so I think that's a lot of what is going on here. Again, I understand people have, you know, and rightfully so, might have some issues with the way the way Bruce Lee was portrayed in the context of the film. But I would also say, let's look at the context of the film, and also look at sort of, again, we have the historic parameters, but there is this gray area, if you will, the sandbox, where we are playing with sort of the historical context, if you will. And to me, that kind of also speaks to the larger point that this film is trying to get at, which is both, obviously, Rick, but in this case, Cliff, they're sort of has-beens. They're fading. You know, the stuntman is being replaced by people like Bruce Lee in sort of this new age in Hollywood and movie making and stunt performance. And so in that context, it is sort of like the past running up against the future. And given the fact that this is this is a fairy tale. This is a fantasy in that sense. It makes sense that number one, you know, Bruce Lee would be presented as kind of the, I don't want to call him the villain in this context, but would sort of be presented as, you know, someone that Cliff would have no respect for, that someone that Cliff would go out of his way to, you know, to make a fool out of, because in his eyes, this guy is taking away his livelihood, taking away his role, if you will, in Hollywood. And so, of course, he's going to, you know, spin it in a different way that it might otherwise be in our own reality. That was a long-winded answer other than just to sort of say, like, I understand the criticism, but at the same time, I sort of reject it in a way because I'm looking at it within the context of the particular story.
That's the thing. It's not, this is not Bruce Lee. First of all,
yeah.
It is not Bruce Lee. This is a caricature of Bruce Lee. That's what it is. Quentin Tarantino has done this before with like Inglourious Basterds. He takes a historical thing, makes it his own, and molds it the way it needs to be. So I have no issue with this scene. And to your point about how we make up stories, it actually reminds me of another Brad Pitt film, An Interview with the Vampire. You see everything from Louis' perspective. And the way he colors characters is very specific to the way he perceives that. And it's the same thing here. And we've seen this in films, a dozen films at least, I'm sure. It's not a new concept. I think that people just had issue with Bruce Lee being used here. But again, it's not Bruce Lee. It is a slightly heightened sense of reality, and it is from Cliff's perspective. And if you just kind of watch it for what it is, it's a pretty good time. This is actually, it's not my favorite scene, but it's like number two or three.
Mm.
I love the Cliff Bruce Lee scene. It is just one of my favorite sequences in the film. I love Mike Moe as Bruce Lee. I think he's hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good time.
It's another situation that goes on a lot in this film, but in this case particular, it subverts the expectations.
It does.
We go into this thinking Cliff is going to get his ass handed to him. And it's both funny and interesting when the reversal happens. And again, that sort of is what this film is ultimately trying to get at. It's setting things up in our mind for it to go a certain way and then just getting it turned on its head.
Yeah, it's just a build. This is part of that build.
Yeah.
And it's also a good look at Cliff because, like you said, we don't really know what Cliff's deal is.
Right.
Cliff seems like a cool guy, but you hear this about him. He can't work with Randy's guys. Oh, this is why. Okay.
Yeah.
He threw Bruce Lee in a car door and he dented the car door with his body and he just got right back up. It's a fantasy, guys.
Yeah.
You know, it's just for fun. It's for shits and giggles. And also the way that scene ends.
The whole
wife coming and screaming at him.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was your car.
Yeah, I know.
Like that makes a difference.
The one-liners in this film are some of the best in any script. I mean, it's like candy for your ears in a lot of ways. I mean, just again, I've said, like, you know, I'm Rick fucking Dalton. Like that line, like, you want to, like, sort of incorporate that into your own life in some way. Like, you know, I'm Phil fucking Walsh. Like, you know, you want to,
that's like an affirmation, you know?
You do.
How you start your day off. Like, this is me.
That's right.
But the film, and I think what helps the one-liners is, in the case of Cliff specifically, Brad Pitt has his charisma. I think he brings to almost every movie he's in.
Yeah.
Except like Benjamin Button, because that's a whole different thing.
Right. We won't go into that today.
No, not today. That's just maybe another day. But he has his charisma. So when he says certain things, they just roll off his tongue and it's great.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Leonardo DiCaprio. He's arguing about whiskey sours again in that scene. And it's just, I love it. I remember after seeing it for a while, I did that too. So whatever line it was, because I also drink whiskey sours. So it was a thing for me. And that's it. Like even Kurt Russell in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
When he has to translate what his wife just said into like a one-liner, it just works.
Yep.
It's got so many memorable lines because of the delivery and the quality of these actors. Well, even the Mike Moe thing, my hands are registered weapons.
Right. No, again, like that's another situation where like it could have just been, all right, it's a throwaway line, or it's a cheap canned line. But again, everybody brings such an authenticity to it. And even if they're over the top in some, in some cases, like, again, we'll save discussion about the ending towards the end, but like, yeah, but like, I think of like the line from Tex, where it's like, you know, I'm as real as a donut. Like, you know, like that. I line,
that line. I, that, like, what does that even mean?
Exactly, what does it mean? But again, you buy it, you know, because everybody is saying it with sincerity and heart behind it.
Even like when they go to Spawn Ranch and he's talking to George.
Yeah.
It's like, you woke me up and I don't know who you are. That could have been so silly, but again, it works.
Again, no, everybody is on their A game here. And
also, the different tones between the characters. Where like Cliff is always calm and collected, and he's put with characters who are not calm and collected.
Yeah.
So it's a great, you know, it's a great back and forth there.
It really sets the dichotomy of the tone. Again, especially since, you know, in his case, his character, you know, again, much like Mike, much like Rick, is sort of like somebody who was fading into the rear view. And in a lot of ways, that could make somebody very agitated, very, very angry, very, you know, trigger happy. But like you said, he sort of holds it together. He maintains that cool.
Even during the ending.
maybe some, you know, drugs help with that.
Yeah, maybe.
It's that coolness that exists throughout it that kind of offsets it with a lot of the hyper and really, you know, out of control characters who. Yeah. Again, in some ways, like, you sort of look at the hippies, and I sort of put that in the large context. They're sort of representing the, you know, again, the changing of the guard, if you will, in sort of both in American culture and also with what's going on in Hollywood. And you sort of think, okay, since they're ascendant, like, they should be the ones calm and cool and like, we're in control now, man. But yet they're all the ones who are kind of erratic and all over the place.
Dakota Fanning is Squeaky is.
Yeah, that's an unsettling performance.
It is, but it goes back to like, if they were in for 5 minutes, if they're for the whole movie,
right?
They leave an impression. Yeah. Her lines are, I don't know how to describe her lines, but they're memorable.
Yeah.
And they're weird. And they just stick with you.
The first time I saw this, I remember thinking to myself, I'm really afraid of this person. I wouldn't want to, like, I saw her on the street, I would go the other way.
Yeah, something about, and I don't mean this in a horrible way, this barefoot hippie just hanging out and speaking the way she does.
Yeah.
Was unsettling. Like, no, I really thought George was dead in the back the first time I saw
him. No, I kept thinking, I said, George is going to fall out of the, you know, the closet door or something like that. I mean, just again, the way she was like going on about, like, you know, I got to, you know, you're going to wake him up.
Watch FBI.
Like, even that was a, you know, creepy vibe. I was like, okay, like, what's going on here every Sunday night?
It's a whole thing. The whole Spawn Ranch scene is full of tension, which is odd for this film, but it I don't want to keep saying it, but it works.
Right. And again, that's sort of we mentioned earlier, that's the beauty of this movie. It keeps building and building. You sort of get at the start with what's happening with both Rick and Cliff. You get the sense that Hollywood is changing. You sort of see that with the rise of Sharon Tate. You have the introduction of Roman Polanski and sort of what he represents as an, you know, auteur filmmaker in the Hollywood, you know, again, changing of the guard and the old studio system falling apart. You sort of get this kind of like, all right, things are unsettling here. Things are sort of moving in different directions. And then of course we get to Spawn Ranch, which again, the fact that it's an old Hollywood backlot and it's all decrepit and rotting away, sort of again representing the changing of the Hollywood system. And you're exactly right. Even though nothing nefarious happens, shall we say, the tension that exists in that entire sequence it's brilliantly crafted because you do not know what's going to happen. And I like that Tarantino introduces Charles Manson and his cult, his followers, whatever you want to call them. And they're sort of out there in the background, and there's sort of almost this dark cloud that's sort of like threatening the blue skies, if you will. And I like how we don't know what is going to happen, but yet at the same time, and again, we'll get into this more when we get to the ending, he's able to reduce them to irrelevant jokes in the movie. And I think that goes, again, back to my point earlier about the subversion of expectations, because you sort of think, oh, the Manson family is here. Like, we know what that represents, what we know what that means. Yeah. And he reduces them to basically a bunch of barefoot hippies. I mean, and again, in a way that, yes, this is fantasy, but it sort of takes the spotlight away from them and brilliantly puts it on the people who should be in the spotlight, if that makes sense.
That's a perfect way to put it, actually. I remember leading up to the film, I could have swore that they tried to, well, not that they tried to, but it sounded like it was going to be a Manson family movie as the front of the story, and then Cliff and Rick were the background.
That's what I thought going into it.
And they made a big deal of, oh, they cast Charles Manson, the Manson family.
Yeah.
So when you watch and you see that's not what it is, it was almost a relief in a way.
Yeah.
Because I would have watched Tarantino do the Manson family either way, but this was much more special. And like you said, it puts the spotlight on the people that it should be on, right, not a bunch of murderous cult members.
Yeah.
And it does reduce them not just to jokes, but I don't think it humanizes them either, which is also something you would expect this movie to do.
I'm glad you brought that up, because obviously when you're talking about Manson and his family, you could easily have gone in the direction of, it feels weird to say humanizing these people, but yeah, but to put them in a more, sympathetic, but trying to at least get inside the psychology here. And
they didn't know, they were just following.
Yeah, like, and I love it that Tarantino just rips that Band-Aid right off. So now we're going to grind these hippies and freaks and weirdos into the ground where they belong. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, he does it in Tarantino fashion. But I think that was another added layer to this, where it takes away that expectation where you think, oh, okay, the Manson family is going to play a prominent role in this film, and they're more or less background characters at best, and not in a way that even impacts the story. They do impact the story, but not in the way that we expect. And again, that's another added layer of brilliance, where you just sort of reduce Chucky and his following to essentially a splinter that you might get in your toe that, you know, you rip out and that's the end of him.
You know, another thing about it is, and this is a compliment to the way the story unfolds and the way it's constructed, there is a plethora of future Hollywood talent on Spawn Ranch.
Yes.
After watching the movie, though, I didn't remember seeing any of these people before when I'd seen them in a new project. Like when I saw Austin Butler and something, like, who's Austin Butler? I've never seen this guy. That guy? Oh, okay. Yeah. Mikey Madison, exact same. Like, I've seen Mikey Madison other than Scream.
Right.
Sydney Sweeney, no clue she was in this.
Maya
Hawke, yeah. They just fade into the background, and not like, oh, they're forgotten characters. No. That is the intention.
Right.
It's not a mistake. That is intentional, that they are not the spotlight. And it's the tale is woven so well. They're just cogs in this machine.
Exactly. I mean, again, anyone watching on YouTube, or certainly, you know, if you've seen the poster, there's a reason why the three prominent people on that poster are Margot Robbie, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Brad Pitt. And in that particular case, their character, Sharon Tate, Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth, because that's who this story is about. It is about these three individuals who interestingly enough, don't really interact with one another outside of a few moments, particularly with Dalton and Sharon Tate. But it's not like they're wound in the narrative with each other, but yet their stories are all connected, and they sort of answer to each other in a way that kind of gets to the whole, you know, sort of brilliant rewriting of history that this film achieves.
Yeah, and I like that they were separate. I think if you would have had them interact more, it might have taken away from what happens.
Right.
So I think keeping them separate, and also Rick kind of looking up at the house, like, oh, that's where I should be too, but I'm down here.
Right, I'm down at the bottom of the hill. Yeah.
It's that contradiction, and the rising star, the fading star. One is at the bottom, one is at the top. They have to go up the driveway and pass right by him.
That's right. That's right.
And he makes the comment, this is the first time I've seen him. We've been living here this long. This is the first time I've seen him.
No, those little moments just sort of enhance it. Mm-hmm. And I like how Tarantino is, I mean, obviously he's a student of film history, but he's sort of acknowledging what was the reality for a lot of actors at that particular time. Again, now these types of situations don't really happen anymore because of the change in media and the fact that, you know, now, you know, actors will do TV shows at the drop of a hat. I mean, it's not uncommon to see, like, you know, Meryl Streep go and do Only Murderers in the Building, whereas 1969, like, if you were a television actor, your goal was to make the jump to the big screen. Mm-hmm. And if you were somehow relegated in the other way, it was a demotion. TV was not what it is today. It was low entertainment. And it's just sort of interesting and appreciative that he can acknowledge what was the reality. Again, I think that enhances the historical aspect of this film, putting aside all the glitz and the, you know, the flashes and whatnot, that this was in fact a reality, that there were many stars who just got swept aside because they either couldn't make the transition from the small screen to the big screen, or just didn't want to adapt and kind of got pushed away.
You know, also a thing that I appreciate, and this is at the very start, it's in that Pacino scene where he explains typecasting without saying typecasting.
Right.
He's having a conversation with Rick, and he's telling him, if you're always the heavy, you're just putting the new star over. You're helping them get bigger while you're getting smaller.
Yep.
And I love that conversation happens too, because again, Tarantino is painting the picture of what it was like to be a TV actor or a movie star gone to TV, I should say.
Right.
But that also applies to movies. And realistically, this didn't change until, I want to say, the last 20 years or so.
I think that is a fair assessment.
I feel like George Clooney is one of the last actors this happened with, but in reverse. He jumped from TV to movies. And at that point, I'd be like, well, maybe the TV stars can do well.
Yeah.
And so you'd see the jump going back and forth from that point on, like 2000s.
I think that's a good point, because yeah, even with the way Hollywood changed kind of post 1969, again, unless you were like Steve McQueen or Clint Eastwood, like, very few actors were successful at making that ultimate transition. And so, you know, again, people like Rick Dalton, you know, again, they either hung on for dear life or they were sadly relegated to, you know, to typecasting. I mean, I think of, you know, someone like the late, great Adam West, for example.
That's who, what I was thinking, too.
Yeah, who, again, it's fitting that we're going to, you know, mention Batman. But, I mean, again, there is a classic case of...
For George Reeves.
George, exactly. You know, another a real tragedy on that particular end. But I mean, that was the reality. I mean, you think of William Shatner for, you know, I mean, he sort
That's
of,
a great example.
You know, was able to dig his way out of it. But I mean, again, you sort of are put in that little box where you are Batman or you're whoever. I mean, and I love when they intercut with Dalton's sort of film reel from back in the day where, like, you know, he's doing like the World War II movie. And again, like,
I like that.
Those kind of moments really just enhance the plight he was in. Like, you know, again, he could have been up for, you know, the Great Escape or something. Or again, he's relegated to, you know, saying corny, you know, one line, like, you know, did somebody order, you know, fried sauerkraut or something like that? Or he's playing, you know,
order fried sauerkraut?
Another great line, you know, but like, you know, he's reduced to that, you know, and it's, and again, it's never like it's done to be like, oh, let's cut the tension here and make this a really, you know, melodramatic moment. But like, you do kind of feel for him because, again, this was such a reality that befell so many stars or you know, quasi stars who just sort of never got their break again. You sort of feel for the struggling actor, if you will.
Another something I think is brilliant about this film and the character's performance is you can kind of see Rick Dalton as a decent actor.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thing when you think about it, because a lot of these films where you see an actor in an actor playing an actor in a movie, you don't get the sense that it's just the actor being the actor.
Right.
In this, Rick Dalton is a living human being, and Rick Dalton is talented.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that again sort of speaks to my point of why I think this is DiCaprio's best film. The fact that he is able to play an actor who is a good actor. Like, you know, again, it's not just, oh, that's Leonardo DiCaprio playing Rick Dalton, who's playing an actor. No, we're not watching Leo. We are watching Rick Dalton, and Rick Dalton is, you know, on the FBI or, you know, whatever. Like, he's an actor. Like, that this is a guy who has, you know, cut his teeth in the business and is doing everything he can, whether it's, you know, making James Bond ripoffs over in Italy or spaghetti westerns. Like, this is a living, breathing actor, and it's such an engaging performance that, again, you never see DiCaprio, even though there's no, you know, prosthetics or anything. Like, we're only watching Rick Dalton.
Yeah, you buy him as Rick Dalton, which is a rare thing with Leonardo DiCaprio, in my opinion. I love him. I think he's one of the best actors we have today. But at the same time, the majority of roles he plays, he is Leonardo DiCaprio. There's only a couple I would say that's, you know, you could kind of take him out of your mind. But this one stands out quite a bit. And I also think it stands out because of Brad Pitt. The chemistry they have is magic.
Yeah.
The scene when before they watch FBI, actually, and Rick Dalton asks him, something like, "You going to come in and watch it?" "Yeah, I already got beers." it's good. It works.
No, that their chemistry, again, like I said at the start, this could have just been a 2.5 hour buddy movie with them. I would watch that cut in a heartbeat. Like, their chemistry and dynamic and friendship is really the backbone of this movie. Like, even when it gets to the point where, you know, Rick can no longer afford him, and like, and they, you know, they go out for one last night of drinking and good times. Like you really feel for it. Like, again, it never comes across as either forced or, like, you know, that phrase movie friendship. You know what I mean? Like, you get the feeling these are two best buds. They're like brothers in a way, and that dynamic, again, it comes across on screen, but it also just enhances the overall dynamic of the movie that, you know, these are two best friends, and, you know, they have been put through, you know, unbelievable circumstances of both luck and just like, what the hell, man.
I want to believe they're actually friends.
Yeah,
like, I want to believe Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt call each other daily now. It would make me feel better about life.
Watching this movie, you want to believe that.
They're just so good together. It's this simple dialogue that sells it. You know, it just, like, the come in here, fucker. Right. I love that.
That's right. Now, again, they're watching TV. Like, it's all real. I mean, I know that's, I feel like it's an overused word, but it feels grounded. It comes across as
an anchor to it.
Exactly.
Even the one of my favorite things is when he's talking about the acid cigarette.
Yeah.
He's explaining, I'd rather trip here than home.
Right.
I thought that was fun.
Again, the one-liners in this film, it's just like, it's a brilliant script. I mean, you know, how this didn't win Best Original Screenplay at the Oscars, I don't know. I mean, that's again a discussion for another day. I mean, I know Parasite won, which is an equally deserving film, but that's like, you are sort of, you know, up against, you know, a giant in that sense. But
I would say though, this is more of a feel good film.
Yes. No, Parasite is definitely not a feel good. Like, yeah, no, you definitely leave this movie with a bounce in your step. But yeah, just the dialogue in this film, and I would say that this is Tarantino's most restrained film. And what I mean by that is we've all seen a Quentin Tarantino film, and you kind of know what you're going to get with one of his films. And I love how he holds himself back in this one, where you think something is going to happen, but then it doesn't. I think of like the Spawn Ranch scene, for example. Outside of the tension in that, you're waiting for it to become Tarantino-esque. And yes, there's a little knockdown, drag out with Booth and one of the hippies, but it's not. It's again, it's very dialed back, and I think that's a brilliant part on Tarantino's part, that he saves kind of what he is known for, his sort of over the top blood and spectacle. He saves right for the end and kind of holds himself back and kind of lets the story go in its own flow and direction, as opposed to like, oh, let's just have everybody shoot each other here or what have you. Like it's very restrained. And I appreciated that. And more so on this one, where I think maybe because I had watched Inglourious Basterds mm-hmm. beforehand, it was kind of nice to see that juxtaposition. All right, this is sort of, you know, Tarantino, you know, unleashed, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And this is him much more in control. It really does feel like, I mean, this was, I said at the start, this was all of his, you know, film mechanics and ingenuity coming to this perfect movie.
I would say Nolan has Oppenheimer, Villeneuve has Dune 2, for me Scorsese has The Departed or Goodfellas, take your pick, Tarantino has this.
Bingo.
This movie is the culmination of everything he's done. It's him knowing when to push, when to hold back. It's him balancing everything that makes his movie special. This is the magnum opus of it all, because it's still very much a Quentin Tarantino movie. His stamp is all over this thing, but it's spread out over the course of the 2 hours and 40 minutes to where it's not as in your face as when you watch like The Hateful Eight or Django. If you go back and watch Pulp Fiction, or Reservoir Dogs was probably my second favorite movie.
Oh, yeah.
I love Reservoir Dogs. Or third, I'm sorry. Django was two. It's just kind of a different beast because it's so well balanced.
Mm-hmm.
He really did take everything he's learned over this time, and he's utilizing it in a different way here. But it's not like a Tarantino fan will watch this and say, this isn't Tarantino. No, this is his at his best.
Yeah. No, it's all his signature is all over this mm-hmm. movie. And I love how it is almost, it is a grand epic yeah. in a way. And I think that's, I mean, not to say that some of his other films don't have an epic quality, but this one, just in terms of the scope and the scale to this film, and maybe a lot of it is because of the attention to detail. I mean, the fact that they painstakingly went out of their way to recreate Hollywood circa 1969. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, again, just the fact that they shut down the Hollywood highway for like an hour and a half to shoot some of the driving sequences and actually got real cars and as opposed to like CGI models. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, later on, like when they couldn't find a car, they would use like a miniature or like a little model set. Like that kind of attention to detail just sort of enhances the overall enjoyment, but also the quality of this film. Like you feel like you're watching something that is again, I use that word, it is epic.
I also think it's timeless. Like if someone were to tell me this was actually made in like 1973, I wouldn't really question it, because other than, of course, the familiar actors, it right. has that classic look to it. It's even shot a certain way. It doesn't have the cuts that Tarantino usually has.
No, that's a good point. It does have like an early 1970s vibe to it. And again, even going back to what I've said at the beginning about the staging with Bounty Law and some of the old bumper reels, like that again just enhances the quality to this movie, where it feels like it's from yesteryear.
Mm-hmm. And it also has like the same vibe you get watching those old films.
Yeah.
Is here. And also the needle drops are more intentional here than yes. I feel like they are in other films. Like the Jose Feliciano California Dreaming. I actually don't like that song, but that version I will listen to because I connected with this.
Yeah. No, every music cue here feels perfect and pertinent to each individual scene, mm-hmm. and not just we got to have a musical cue or a mic or a needle
there's
drop.
No stuck in the middle with you moment.
No, that's right. No, everything feels again like we're propelling forward, and it's a reflection of what is going on in the particular time or what's going on underneath the surface.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
I mean, there are so many moments in this film, and God, we barely scratched the surface. What would be like? And again, we're going to save the ending for the end, because I mean that's a whole other discussion. But putting that aside, what would be your top two or top three favorite scenes from this film? And I know that's like again trying to pick a favorite child.
For me, this movie start to finish is just wonderful. My very favorite scene is when he's arguing with himself in the trailer. That scene there's no flaw. There's no flaw. That scene, the Bruce Lee scene, and the third favorite scene for me, it might be that opening Al Pacino scene.
Oh,
I just really, even when the first time I saw it, that scene stuck with me, because you have two greats of Hollywood on, well, three, because Brad Pitt's in the background, right. But you have like three greats of Hollywood on screen together,
mm-hmm.
and they're holding their own, and you don't see them. You see these characters. Al Pacino, for whatever reason, I don't think if you saw him on the street, this would work, but he looks like an old studio exec. And the way he speaks to Rick Dalton, the heavy conversation, typecasting, and all that, it just works so well for me. So those are my top three. An honorable one, though, I really love when Cliff talks to George. Like an honorable mention, for some reason, I just love that scene. Because you kind of, first of all, you expected George to be dead, right?
Right.
And secondly, George has no idea who he is, but Cliff thought, oh, this is my guy.
Right.
Yep. And I'm thinking, does the guy have dementia? What's going on? No, he just doesn't know who Cliff is.
Yeah. It's, I love everything that you just said. Like, I mean, again, there's so much in this movie. I mean, but it's like start to finish, like the whole damn movie is just perfect. Like it's like you could pick any number of scenes and be like, oh, okay, that's a good one. That's a good one. That's a good one.
It's hard to narrow it down.
Yeah. For me, the entire Spawn Ranch sequence is just perfection. I mean, again, that whole exchange with George, like, again, that sort of gets, can't go wrong with that. Now that's unsettling in its own way, but like the whole thing with George, like that speaks to the movie's whole point about the sort of the fading star and, you know, the has-been, if you will. I love that whole, just that entire scene is excellent. Again, especially you're expecting something to happen, but then it doesn't. And you never feel let down or cheated as a result. And again, the Pacino scene, I mean, that is the chef's kiss right there. Another scene that I actually really enjoy, and it's not like much happens in it necessarily, but you get a real good sense about where Cliff is at and his character. When he goes back to his trailer and it's literally situated right behind an old drive-in movie screen. And he's just in there. He's got his dog. He's pouring out the dog food. And he's making himself macaroni and cheese out of the box. And it, I don't know. It's just one of those character moments where you see who the guy is. Like, for all of his bluster and all of his BS and sort of like, okay, what's going on with Cliff here? Like, this is what he has been. This is what he's reduced to. This is the stuntman. He's living in a trailer behind a drive-in movie screen, and it's just him and his dog. And it's such a well-executed scene with just sort of the attention to detail, but also with the character moment. Like, you really get a sense, like, this is probably who Cliff is day in and day out, and what we see out there is just sort of the mask.
That was a surprise to me. You see him go to the drive-in, like, oh, what is he doing at the drive-in? Mm. Oh, he lives in the trailer, though. Okay.
Yeah.
This is different. And then you think, well, Rick is in, like, a mansion right now.
Yeah.
This guy's in a trailer, and he's perfectly happy with it.
Yeah.
He doesn't even use a plate when he starts eating. He eats out of the pot.
Right, exactly.
Just a bachelor, I guess. I don't know.
But bachelor lifestyle.
Like you said, it subverts the expectations, and this really did, too, because you kind of expect – well, so as soon as you see Cliff getting the beat up car, like, oh, wait a minute, something's different.
Yeah, it's not and quite the same.
Yeah, then you see him in the trailer, like, oh, they are very different, but they have that commonality where they are friends.
Yeah.
This works even better now.
No, again, it enhances their whole camaraderie. The mm-hmm. fact that, you know, again, Rick is in the quasi-mansion, if you will.
On the hills. He's
up on the hill. Yeah, and Rick's living over in a trailer behind a movie screen, but yet they're best friends. There's no sort of like, well, I'm the actor, you're my stunt double. Like, even though there is that difference, if you will, in professions, they're on the same playing field. Mm-hmm. And again, sort of by the situation, but also by the fact these are two best buds.
I love that aspect of it. I really do. And also I love the driving parts with Cliff.
Yeah.
I think those are, you don't really pay attention to them really. But the way they're shot and the way they look are just really nice.
I mean, that's the thing. The cinematography in this film, and I just want to get the cinematographer, Robert Richardson. I mean, what he does in this film, you said it perfectly, Chris. It feels and looks like a movie that was made circa 1973. Mm-hmm. It just, from the way it's shot, the camera angles, it is, that's probably the least Quentin Tarantino ask about this film is that it isn't cut in a traditional Tarantino fashion,
which I appreciate because I love his stuff as is, but to see him branch out and it still work, that is talent.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, this is, that's a mark of a great director right there. Absolutely. We've sort of been hinting at it. We've been sort of, you know, leading up to this discussion because the ending of this movie, I mean, in many ways, like, this sort of, like, in many ways, it makes or breaks the whole film. Like,
it did.
You know, again, for me, I mean, this just sealed the deal why I thoroughly enjoy this film and again consider it his best movie to date. And it's one of my just favorite films just mm-hmm. because of where we ultimately get to in this movie. As we said earlier, the Manson family is sort of in the background here, and the movie sets you up to think, well, all right, this is 1969. We know what happens in the summer of 1969 with Sharon Tate and the Manson family. We know where the house is. Okay, it's all been established that things are leading up to this particular night. And it is, we're meant to think that, okay, it's going to be just a recreation of a historical event. But the movie does a brilliant job as it sort of teased throughout by subverting our expectations and sort of shows how, you know, how one event can change an entire course of history, you know, sort of the butterfly effect, mm-hmm. if you will. And in this particular case, the Manson family, the Tate murder does not happen. And that is, again, I think part of the the fantasy element of this film. It's part of the sweet revenge that Tarantino, I think, is getting at, where he's sort of giving these people the second chance they didn't get in life, in the case of Sharon Tate, and the fictionalized case of Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth. He's allowing history to go sort of bend in a different way, and as we said earlier, reduces the Manson family and followers to essentially a bunch of caricatures and jokes who get mutilated and torched by the end of the film in perfect Tarantino fashion, I must add. But now that I've set the stage, again, the ending, it makes or breaks this film for a lot of people. For me, it made it. It just enhanced it all the way. Chris, let me know your thoughts on this, on the ending, and we can kind of pick it apart the best possible way.
The fun thing about the ending for me is that if it didn't have this wacky Tarantino-fueled ending, I still would have loved this movie.
Yeah.
If it would have ended with just Cliff and Rick having that last night out, and then the next day they go their separate ways like Superbad, I would have been cool with it. But the fact that Tarantino said, you know what, I've been a good boy all this time. I've been good. And then he gives you the full effect, made me love this movie even more. It is wacky. It is unnecessary in some ways, but I adore it. And like to think about it, and this might sound weird, but in the context of the film, Sharon Tate was saved by Rick Dalton's drunken rant. And I don't think there's a better punctuation mark for this movie than that point. That is what saved the day. Rick going outside, pitcher full of frozen margaritas, arguing with Tex about being a hippie in his car.
Yep.
And it is beautiful the way it all unfolds from that point on.
Yep.
Including when they realize who he was.
Right.
They didn't even know.
No. That whole scene in the cab where they have no idea this guy is. Yeah. And then it's like, that's Rick Dalton. I had him in my lunch bucket as a kid.
Yeah, and Mikey Madison, I forgot what her name was, had no idea what they were even talking about.
Oh, that's right. She's like, I'm sorry I didn't recognize every fascist who was on TV. Exactly. In the 50s.
And then she goes on that weird spiel about, let's kill the people that taught us to kill. It's like, what is happening?
No, again, the fact that Tarantino is able to rewrite history, like you said, just based on the fact that Rick Dalton came out there and cursed these people out, drunk as a skunk in his bathroom, no less.
Threatening them with the police.
It's just like,
it's a private drive.
It just adds to the wacky mayhem that ultimately follows, because again, it is Tarantino sort of getting justice, if you will. And that kind of may seem strange for people, but like there is sort of that poetic justice that, okay, Sharon Tate didn't get it in real life, but she's getting it in this reality, if you will. And I really find that endearing, that, like I said, it reduces the Manson crew to a bunch of, just, hippies running around in the dark and getting torched and whatnot, and they all live happily ever after. I think there's something really poetic about that.
There is, and it's a story that gives you a feel good ending when you did not think that was going to happen.
No, again, you know, just based on the historical context, what happens on that particular day, and so you're thinking, okay, well, this really can only go one way. And the fact that it doesn't, it goes the way that the story unfolds. Again, it gives you that satisfying conclusion. I mean, and again, it's where you are cheering on Dalton and Booth as they are literally taking down the Manson family, one at a time in the house, and the dog.
The dog, yeah.
Brandy
gets in on that too.
Yeah,
it's like another cool thing is, like, you don't even see Charles Manson. You see him once,
exactly.
And I like that he's not in the finale.
No, he's reduced to a background character, mm-hmm. and that's where he stays. Again, that's, I think, part of the real genius of Tarantino here. He's putting them kind of in their place, so to speak,
yes.
and does it in a way where we as the audience kind of feel vindicated and cathartic by the time that it all unfolds. Because, like you said, I mean, it happens by accident. And then, of course, you know, it's sort of like, you know, Home Alone-esque in a way, but much more fun.
So the rated R Home Alone.
Yeah, that's it.
It's just a nice butterfly effect.
Yeah.
Because if Rick Dalton doesn't come out going nuts,
history unfolds the right way it does. Yeah.
So it's a really nice way to handle that butterfly effect. And it's also something I love Tarantino. This is the second time he's done it, where he rewrites history in a way that works better.
It does. Again, it kind of give you, know, you kind of have your cake and eat it too moment. Right. And I mean, plus you get to use the flamethrower again, which is pretty cool. You know, so we don't have Chekhov's gun. We have Chekhov's flamethrower in this.
And it's funny the way it even works out with that.
Yeah,
you know, even the donut thing, which you mentioned earlier, I love that line. But also the "I'm the devil and I'm here to do the devil's business."
And again, in another context, that would be an unnerving, frightening, mm-hmm. demonic, disturbing, you know, pick your adjective line. But Tarantino is able to frame it, of course, in a way where Cliff is already high at this point. And he's like, "Are you real?" Like, I mean, again, he's reducing these people to absolute jokes. Where a line like, you know, "I'm, you know, here to do the devil's work," like, he's busting a gut over this. You know, Rick is out in the pool listening to his the radio, oblivion. Like when
singing along.
Yeah, I mean, like when Mikey Madison's character falls out the window, he's like, you know, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, he's checking out, he got close. Is she okay?
He immediately goes to the garage and gets the flamethrower. Like it just reducing the Manson folks to jokes. Like again, I think that was a stroke of brilliance. Because I mean, like you said, it doesn't put them in either a psychological character study, mm-hmm. or a profile. It just reduces them to jokes.
I don't want to say a lesser filmmaker would have done the opposite, but I feel like that was the easier route to go, was to try to get in some of, like, at least, let's say, Tex's head.
Right.
Or one of these main characters that come to do the attack.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do that. You kind of get it with Maya Hawke, but it's fleeting.
Yeah.
It's really well handled. Like, she realizes this is messed up. I'm not doing this.
Right. But it doesn't stay on it enough. Like, it doesn't make
right. it doesn't
impact the other.
Anything.
Right. Exactly.
Still have three psychos.
Right. And it sort of is almost a callback to how some movie villains were portrayed kind of post 1969. And what I mean by that is, I think of a film like Dirty Harry, for example, which, I mean, I'm a big fan of that film in its own right. But the character of Scorpio, like, you can watch it as sort of like a riff on the Zodiac Killer. But in a lot of ways, like, the movie is smart where it doesn't try to get inside the head of this person. Like, he's just a bad guy. He's a sick individual, and that's all we need to know about him. And that kind of felt to me, that was almost like a hat tip Tarantino was doing with how he constructed these three characters. Like, they're sort of those, like, I don't want to say classic movie villains, but in a way, like, they are simply here as the heavies, if you will. And that's all they're there for. And when we're done with them, we are done with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because too many modern films try to make the villains three-dimensional.
Right.
I don't always want a three-dimensional villain. Sometimes I just want a bad person.
And that's all, again, I mean, not to go off on too much of a rant, but, like, that's why we don't ever need an Emperor Palpatine origin story movie.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
I don't want it. I don't care what happened to him. I like
doesn't
Palpatine.
Matter. That's right. Leave it. Sometimes a bad guy is just a bad guy.
And these guys are just bad.
Exactly. We don't
need to know anything. And taking Charles Manson out of the picture really makes them look even worse, I think.
It does. And that kind of complements the Maya Hawke situation where she runs away. Yeah, it does. It puts them in a different context.
It really does. And the chaos that ensues in the house is, it's Tarantino. I mean, it's wild.
No, like I said, he is restrained in this entire movie until this sequence. I mean, this is, when you go see a Tarantino film, this is kind of what you're paying to ultimately get to. And he lets it go. And he doesn't hold back.
It's kind of like the Django Mansion slaughter.
Yeah.
But all at one time.
Yes, that's what it is. It's yep.
That violence in that one scene. Well, the whole movie leads up to that scene. But, you know, all of that, he just throws it here.
Yeah. He hits the pedal to the metal with this. And it's
it's just wild. And like the way Mikey Madison, she's just a trooper in movies where they're trying to kill her.
I know. Literally, I mean, between Scream and this, like, I mean, she has earned her badge just for that.
Even that, what was the movie we just watched recently with her, daughter? I forgot what it was called.
Lost Souls? Oh, All Souls, yeah.
All Souls. Right. Even in that, they try to kill her. You couldn't keep her down.
No, again, Mikey just keeps going. She just
Tough
keeps.
Lady.
No, she is. Definitely with the flamethrower. It was sort of funny watching Scream a few years later. Yeah. Just kind of see, like, oh, that's kind of an interesting callback. They burned her again, you know. Not quite as, you know, intense with the flamethrower. You know, that kind of, you know. That's at a class all by itself.
Had the flamethrower just makes it even better.
Like I said, when that showed up, like, I mean, I remember watching the first time thinking, okay, I wonder if that's ever going to appear again. Because like that's such a cool weapon, especially like when they show like the behind the scenes moment where he's like, oh, it's really hot. And it's like, Rick, it's a flamethrower. It doesn't go any cooler. So like the fact that it comes full circle there was just, again, it was just the cherry on top. Like, and Quentin Tarantino, he knows how to deliver those moments that you're kind of expecting for. Like, that's where he does deliver for your expectations.
He does, and I think the humor and the chaos also makes the unsettling nature of it easier to swallow, because at the heart of it is actually a terrifying scenario.
Oh, no. Again, in another director's hands, and you alluded to it, this would be, I mean, obscene would be putting it one way, you know, and that's probably putting it mild. He's able to downplay the violence in a way where it is over the top. It is graphic. It is obscene, but yet he's able to make you both laugh and cheer at what's happening. And again, I think that sort of goes to the sort of fantastical elements that he weaves into all of his films, where it is almost like a surreal dreamlike experience.
But it makes me think of some of our favorite slashers. You know, you and I both love Halloween.
Yep.
You know, if this was Michael Myers in this scenario, there would be no humor. Just death.
No. Yep.
Or you think of Scream, even Ghostface chasing people through a house, which is what this was.
Yep.
It would have been a very different scenario. But because it's Tarantino and he knows how to balance this so well, because this is what he does.
Yep.
You accept that Cliff Booth has ruined this woman's. There's no face left.
No, it's gone. Yep.
It is all gone.
Yep.
Even the first shot with the can of food on Matthew Madison. Completely destroyed her.
Yeah, took her down.
Yeah, I don't even think he kills Tex himself. I don't remember. I think Brandy.
Yeah, I think Brandy pretty much takes care of Tex.
Yeah, I think maybe Cliff delivers a finishing blow, but Brandy knocks him.
Yeah,
out Brandy, pretty much.
Yeah, Brandy found a new chew toy.
Yeah, a couple of them.
Yeah, that's right.
She had a great time.
A good time was had by all. No, honestly. Yeah, it's. It's probably one of my favorite endings to any of his films. It just because, again, it is cathartic in a weird way, and it feels earned. Like the movie was building towards this conclusion, and it pays off on so many different levels. Whereas, again, as I've said, the Manson family is reduced to, you know, a burnt corpse in a swimming pool and a dog's chew toy. But then you also get the added bonus of the rewriting of history in a positive way. And again, I love it how the film ends with Rick going up to the house finally, mm-hmm. and just having that moment that, like, you know what, it is going to be okay. Like Sharon Tate is going to go on. She's going to have a prosperous career, and Dalton is going to be able to make the leap. He's going to be able to go on. Exactly. He has the comeback, and he's already got this, you know, this sort of moment, if you will. And I mean, this is one moment where I will like segue into the novelization of this movie, which, if you are a fan of novelizations, I would encourage you to read it, because the book adds a lot more context to the film. It also reworks it in an interesting way, whereas the finale of the movie is actually much earlier on. Oh. And it works – well, so the way it works is the film sets it up where – Dalton and Cliff have saved the day and dispatched with the Manson people, and it's sort of dealing with the aftermath of that and kind of how he becomes a folk hero in a way, like on like late shows and things of that, and kind of seeing his career revived, and then ultimately sort of working backwards, sort of telling his story of, you know, sort of up and comer, then ultimately making his, you know, way to TV, and then trying to find his way back again. It's the same story, same movie, but just sort of done in reverse in a way, but also adding a little more insight into it. So it kind of, you know, shows you where ultimately where things might have gone, you know, from here, if you will.
I kind of like that. That's interesting.
Yeah. It's one of those rare cases where, like, it's not just a direct, like, all right, page to or screen to page or vice versa. Like, there's a lot more nuance and subtext and creativity to it than just a standard movie novelization. And maybe because Tarantino wrote it himself, that kind of added to it. But you can kind of see him putting the whole movie into a whole different perspective and context that, for me, ultimately, I thought enhanced it.
Now I kind of want to watch that version too, though.
No, like in many ways
that sounds like an interesting way to do it.
Yeah, it sort of adds a whole other layer to it, particularly with the way he frames it, with what is the ending of the film kind of almost becomes the beginning of the book.
That's cool.
Yeah, no.
But where does the book end then?
So it sort of works its way backwards and ends with, I almost think it's like the scene where he's in the Lancer setup, where like he has that conversation with the girl, like, you know, that was some of the best acting I've ever seen. Like, okay. you get the way it frames, like what I read, it was like, okay, I was not expecting it to go in this way, but it makes sense with the way it's structured.
Well, I was, it's funny you mentioned that, cause I was on Spotify earlier looking for the soundtrack.
Okay.
And I saw they have the audiobook on Spotify.
I would recommend.
I think Jennifer Jason Leigh reads it, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
I think that's who it was. I might check that out.
Yeah, no, definitely, you know, if you have time, this is one of those novelizations I think worth a read. But no, that actually brings to a perfect segue of kind of talking about other versions, because So on April Fool's Day of this year, we got some news that I did not see coming. I don't think anybody did. I think a lot of people actually thought it was an April Fool's joke, which it wasn't.
I was cautious all day.
I know. I kept waiting for the shoe to drop, but you know, fortunately, that did not happen. And so, lo and behold, everybody, there is going to be, yes, a sequel to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now, not a sequel in a direct sense, like it is not going to be a continuation of this story, so we're not going to be seeing what's happening next for Rick, but it is going to center on the adventures of Cliff Booth, and it is going to be, I won't say when it's going to be set, because I don't know if it's actually been confirmed or if it's just speculation, but what we do know is that it is heading to Netflix. Brad Pitt is returning to play Cliff Booth, and lo and behold, it is going to be directed by, hold on to your hat, Mr. David Fincher. So, Chris, what are your thoughts? What are your expectations? What are your hopes?
I will start off by saying I am disgustingly excited. As I think everybody could figure out, I love Once Upon a Time in Hollywood a lot. And I love Cliff. So this news, I am very, very happy about this because I did not see this coming at all. And in a way, I actually love it's going to be done by someone else. Mm-hmm. Tarantino's writing it, of course.
Right.
But with Fincher directing, that's an interesting flavor. Because we've seen things where Tarantino's hand off like to Robert Rodriguez.
Yep.
And I think Rodriguez did a wonderful job with his stuff. So let's see what Fincher does with it. This is going to be interesting. And Fincher's done some good things with Netflix, like the Fassbender Hitman movie. I can't remember what it was called.
Oh, The Killer.
Yeah, I should have remembered that one. The Killer I thought was great. Yep. But also because you'll see Cliff in a whole different lens now, mm-hmm. with Fincher behind the camera. I want to see that. Plus the reteam there. Come on. I feel like the Hulk. This is an absolute win.
I will co-sign that 100% because, again, did I ever think we would be getting a sequel to this? No, because just – why would there be a sequel? Like, I mean, it just would not happen. This wasn't like a Kill Bill situation, right, or whatnot. But the fact that it is coming from Tarantino, there is speculation that maybe parts of the script are from what was going to be his 10th movie. But then when mm-hmm. he decided to pull the plug on that and refocus, again, lot of what ifs and who knows. I mean, there was a rumor. I don't know if it was confirmed about DiCaprio may be in talks to return again. I
don't think that was. I think that was speculation.
That's what I thought.
I don't see him going to Netflix. It's a downgrade or something.
But. No, but I don't see it either. But again, I mean, the fact that David Fincher is directing this, I'm really excited about it because I think this is a good way to go with this story. Not that it's like continuing what we saw and what we've been talking about tonight, but it's centering on Cliff. And again, that could go in many different directions. It could go, I mean, 10 years down the road, it could go, you know, mm-hmm. flashbacks. I mean, there's a lot of material. And again, there's so much there in the film. I feel like you could just pick one thread and make an entire movie about that. Like, what exactly did happen with Cliff on that boat? You know, we really don't know. You know, I mean, that could be where the movie
goes. I hope
they
leave that ambiguous, though.
I'm with you. I think kind of leave that to the imagination.
Yeah, that's best left unexplained, I think.
Yeah.
I would be interested, well, I'm interested anyway, but I think it would be cool if they just changed the era. Like, this is Cliff in the 80s.
Oh, that would be
a Ty West thing.
Yes, I like that.
Let's see Cliff in the 80s.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, particularly as you're going into, like, the age of Arnold Schwarzenegger, right, and Stallone. Yeah.
That was even less room for a stuntman because you had guys that were really doing the stuff.
That's right. Oh, yeah. I'm liking this more and more. No, I'm ecstatic about this. This was, again, I kept waiting on April Fool's Day for it to mm-hmm. be April 2nd just to see if we made it through without it being revealed as a joke. But, no, it is happening, and I believe it is looking to begin filming later this summer. So we're probably not too far off, ladies and gentlemen, from this film dropping on Netflix, which, I mean – yeah, this will already be one of my most anticipated films whenever it is officially announced with a release date. So, you know, sign me up for this particular one, and we'll definitely have you back on, Chris, to discuss mm-hmm. the sequel when it happens. But I mean, just talk about the unexpected. This was a wonderful surprise.
Did not, because we've been waiting for the Kill Bill sequel. We've been waiting for Kill Bill 3 for years. I just realized we're not getting Django and Zorro.
No.
Because he was talking about that for a long time, too. So I figured we're just not going to get sequels. We never even got the Vega Brothers thing.
Right.
But, you know, so it's like, okay, this is just another thing. Just take it for what it is, and we're happy. And that was good.
Right.
But now they're actually going to give us a real sequel to something. And the talent involved with Fincher, like, come on.
Oh, no.
Even if Leo doesn't come back, I don't think he needs to.
No, I don't think he does either.
I think, you know, if they want to have him cameo, like a real cameo, not like an extended performance, like with a real cameo, that might be okay, but don't really need him. I'm very excited to see what they do with this and who else they incorporate in the story. Because Once Upon a Time in Hollywood had a lot of people incorporated into it.
Well, that's what I'm really curious.
Robust Hollywood.
Yeah, and what the potential historical framing could be. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of potential for this. I mean, and I like your thought about it maybe being set in the 80s. That would be kind of cool.
I think that'd be fun. Maybe now he's a stunt director or something.
Yeah. I mean, the sky is really the limit here.
I wonder if the movie The Fall Guy helped this along.
You know, that is an interesting point because, I mean, if you now look at the Academy Awards, there's now going to be honoring best original stunts down the road. So, you know, there may be justice for the stuntman. You know, this
one day.
One day, you know, it's finally happening. But, you know, more adventures of Cliff Booth, I just sign me up. I mean, I would watch an entire series just based on the adventures of Cliff Booth. I would watch a whole series on Bounty Law just for the hell of it.
I would love the Bounty Law series. I know we're not getting it, but I love that.
I would love a Lancer series.
I would watch that too. I would even be happy, but I really would. If Cliff Booth's thing was a series, I would have been the same, just as excited. Maybe even more excited because I knew we'd be getting it weekly or something.
Right.
Or more of it.
Yeah. No, honestly, I'll take as much as I can get in this particular universe because there's a lot of potential for it. And again, particularly with the way Once Upon a Time in Hollywood ends, there's a lot of, you know, butterflies and whatnot that can be affected, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fun stuff to go back to bring into it. Or I don't think it'd be a prequel because Pitt has aged a bit.
Right. Now I can't see them going in that direction.
But if they go like a year before the movie, maybe, but I think you need Leo for that.
Yeah. No, you probably would need Leo. You got to go forward and it's got to be, you know, what trouble is Cliff getting up to now?
Put Tom Cruise in it.
There we go. Now it's a party.
Yeah. Put him in it. They don't like each other anyway.
No. Just adds for the real dichotomy there. You won't get the buddy comedy movie.
You get the rivalry. You know, he's a rival stuntman. That'd be fun.
Oh, there. Let's see. Now we may be onto something there. We may be onto something there.
But whatever they do, I'm in. Just give
it. No, like I said, I will be eagerly awaiting any little information drop on this film. So it's a good day all around. Again, this film in itself is already a classic, and I don't feel that's an overstatement. I think it is a masterpiece in every sense of the word, and I'm eager to see where things go from here. But well, Chris, I think we've said our piece about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Yeah. I mean, again, literally, this could have been another hour plus. I mean, just to go through it scene by scene. But I appreciate you coming back on the show and having this discussion, buddy. Where can people find you on social media and stalk you in the best possible way?
You guys can follow me on Twitter at ThatChris70. I do a bunch of different stuff. It, you can always find it there.
Good stuff. And be sure to give Chris a follow. Always great, amusing takes from him as well as his show as well. But that does it for me today, everybody. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. I'll be back next week where we will do this all over again for the love of movies. Phil's covering every movie dream. Phil at the movies makes every movie.